Life Audio.
You are listening to The Becca Cook Show with your host, Becca Cook. For more information about Beckett and his ministry, visit his website at beckettcook.com. To help support the podcast, visit patreon.com/The Becca Cook Show. Please consider subscribing to the podcast and leaving a 5-star rating. Hey guys, happy Thanksgiving. Today we are going to have a very interesting episode. We're going to be talking about Jordan Peterson and his faith. And my guest is Dr. Bethel McGrew. And she is a freelance writer, a cultural critic. She's written for publications such as National Review, First Things, The Spectator, and many more. She's also a teacher and a PhD in mathematics. So what's interesting about this episode is Bethel and I were talking a couple of weeks ago, and I wanted to do an episode with her on one of her articles, or one of her many, many articles. And she ended up sending me this one on Jordan Peterson, and the title is called Missing God, and the subtitle is Jordan Peterson and the Decline of Atheism. And what's really funny about this is I had dinner with Connie Selica and John Tesh a couple of weekends ago, and we had this a great dinner at this restaurant in Beverly Hills. And when we walked in and sat down, we noticed that right next to us, in a booth right next to us, was Jordan Peterson and his wife. And so we were like, whoa, because Connie and John are fans of Jordan Peterson. And so, and I am too, and I've known about him for a long, long time. And so after dinner, he actually got up with his wife to leave, and we kind of stopped him and we're like, hey, we love you. We love your work. And we ended up in this conversation with him. And, you know, it's funny because Connie asked him just bluntly, she said, you're a Christian, right? And he said, his answer was very revealing, which we'll get into in the episode. But, and then I told him, actually Connie told him about my show, and she said, you need to go on Beckett's show. And so he's like, what's your show? And I said, well, it's called The Becca Cook Show. And I gave him my card, and I had a moment with him, and I told him basically a short version of my story, and I invited him on my show. So we'll see if he contacts me and comes on the show. But then we said, well, what are you doing in LA? Where are you going? And he said, oh, I'm speaking tonight at the YouTube Theater at the SoFi Stadium down by LAX. And we're like, oh, we had no idea that he was even giving a lecture that night. So he said, I would give you tickets, but I've already given them all my free ones out. And so John Tesh was like, we'll just buy tickets. We're coming. And so we decided to go to the lecture, and we drove down all the way down near the airport, and there was a ton of traffic, and we finally get to the lecture, and it was very interesting. He talked a lot about Genesis and Exodus, we're going to get into this with Bethel, but it's just interesting because he really likes to use the framework of the Judeo-Christian biblical kind of worldview. But there seems to be something kind of missing, and we're going to get into that. But first, a word from our sponsor.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now, 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
And so I'm happy to welcome Dr. Bethel McGrew. Welcome.
Thank you, Beckett. Great to be here.
So I was saying in the intro, it's so funny because I just went to Jordan Peterson's lecture the other night, and how this is just kind of dovetailing with this piece that you wrote and what we're talking about today. The timing is just, the timing's pretty hilarious.
Clearly. Yeah.
And so tell us, there may be some people out there who don't know who Jordan Peterson is. So tell us, who is Jordan Peterson and how did he rise to such prominence?
Yes. Okay. So for both of you out there who might not be aware, Jordan Peterson is a former professor, clinical psychologist, Canadian, and he rose to prominence through a couple of different events. He got some political attention because he protested a bill in Canada that would have restricted freedom of speech around trans pronoun usage. So that was at the end of 2016. And then through 2017, he began getting a lot of views for a series of biblical lectures on YouTube. And then he kind of exploded on the scene in early 2018 when he wrote a book called 12 Rules for Life. And that was a bestseller. A little bit of everything, kind of unusual book. It was sort of a self-help book, but you know, kind of strange and different and quirky, and just had a really big impact. And so then he began a massive international speaking tour and became a highly sought after lecturer, speaker, not really a pundit. He wasn't a political thinker, but just sort of bringing all of his insights as a psychologist and trying to apply them to the present day. And he really had a way of speaking to people that was compelling. And so then his career has had a lot of sort of crazy ups and downs since then, but he's still out there and still speaking. And
yeah.
You saw him just the other day.
The critical moment in his rise, or the critical kind of key moment in his, what kind of launched him, was when he was a professor at Harvard, I believe. And then at this time he was at University of Toronto.
Yeah. Right.
And he was, the bill was compelling him to, I guess, use pronouns.
Yeah, right. It was right. It was a compelled speech bill. It would have bundled this kind of thing along with a bunch of other things that were, you know, being counted as discrimination or whatever. He didn't think of himself as a super conservative type guy. He was sort of an old fashioned liberal, but he felt very strongly about compelled speech and had this strong instinct that it was bad news for the government to try to force him to use words that he might or might not want to use. So he spoke out against that, and that kind of got him notoriety in Canada specifically. But I don't think he didn't really break into the wider consciousness until his book came out. And also right. he had a very contentious interview with a British broadcaster that went viral. And that's kind of how
But what you're saying is.
That's right.
He kept putting words in his mouth. What you're saying is.
Exactly. Right. And so she was this, this feminist interviewer, and she was trying to get him to make himself look bad about gender differences between men and women. And he was just very skillful and kind of avoided all her traps. And so that just exploded. And a lot of people like me were sort of like, who is this guy? He's sort of interesting. And then we found out, oh, wow, there's a lot of interesting layers to this guy. He's not really like anyone else who's stepped out onto the stage as a public intellectual before.
Yeah, and I watched recently an interview he did with Piers Morgan, and he said basically with that incident at University of Toronto, he said, "The government cannot have control over my tongue."
Like, yeah,
that's kind of what his. So that was really the thrust of that. And so you wrote this piece and it's called Missing God. The title's Missing God. The subtitle is Jordan Peterson and the Decline of Atheism. Now, so just briefly, like, what is the general thesis of this piece that you wrote?
Sure. So this was a piece that I contributed to an anthology, which is like critical responses to various popular public intellectuals. And so I actually have something coming out in their volume on Sam Harris and maybe later on Steven Pinker. And so this is something I wrote after a couple of years of watching and reflecting on Peterson's work. And I think basically my thesis is that Peterson highlighted the weaknesses and deficiencies of the old new atheist cohort. So, the Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, guys who kind of ruled the atheist airwaves back in the noughties or whatever, that kind of post September 11th milieu. And so then Peterson sort of comes along and really just punctures a lot of that, exposes a lot of that, and it shows, it sort of rediscovers a lot of the power of Christianity and the Bible. Mm-hmm. But now that he's found it, he's sort of himself kind of confused and doesn't quite know what to do with it, or how it all fits together or where to put it in his own worldview. So he's kind of attempting to come along and, and restore some reverence and some dignity to the Christian worldview. But he doesn't really quite know what to make of it himself still.
We'll be right back after this short break. Yeah. And I mentioned this in the intro, that when we were at dinner and we met him, Connie Selica asked him, she said, "You're a Christian, right?" And his response was very telling, mm-hmm. because he said, "I don't talk about that. I don't talk about that in public."
Yeah. Private either. It seems like, cause it sounds like he didn't really answer her in that context,
Yeah. And so I found that very interesting. And so let's get into this piece. You say that you call him a rogue. I love that, the rogue professor. So you say that Jordan Peterson has been. Oh, okay. So when you saw him, you saw him speak in what year was that?
I saw him in May of 2018, actually. So it was like right. Peak Peterson, okay. He was right in his prime. Yeah. Yeah.
And you say for 3 hours, you and your friend sat silent, quietly under the spell for three hours. We were haunted by the problem, which has haunted Jordan Peterson his whole life. How to find the meaning of life now that God is dead and we have killed him. So you're kind of referencing the madman and Nietzsche's, mm-hmm. The Gay Science. And so talk about that a little bit. Like, how is he searching for the meaning of life in these lectures?
So he refers himself to Nietzsche a lot, and how, he has his own kind of spin on what Nietzsche is doing in that passage, where he's saying that it's like this crisis that we're in, where the old frameworks for sense making, for creating meaning, have been broken. The whole, the Enlightenment, rationalism, modernist project sort of broke those. But the problem is that we still need meaning.
Right.
We're still meaning seeking creatures. So how do we find it? What do we do? What does it mean to have faith or to believe in anything? So he's tried to kind of see if he can restart this from the ground up, right? And so that particular night maybe you'll get into this as you keep reading, he was focused on sort of a problem of evil, question, but not,
yeah,
not,
because you, yeah. said that you said he, you were, he was talking about, I guess, the Holocaust and the prisoners in their camps,
right?
And how they were ordered to carry, they were forced to carry 100-pound salts of sacks of wet salt back and forth. And basically the whole point was inflicting maximal pain. And Peterson found his absolute, as you say in this piece, his absolute was, this is wrong.
Yeah.
And you say, and that he could conclude that there are unquestionably evil acts, but you say, but there was the rub. On some level, Peterson still believed the atheist critique of religion was correct, but he was still a modern man as such, and as such, he couldn't be a religious man. So he's kind of in this bind because he wants the framework of a Judeo-Christian world, but
right, and he's kind of making it's like he's reinventing the moral argument essentially, right? And so he's concluding, okay, there's such a thing as objective evil, so then, you know, the opposite has to be true. There should be such a thing as objective good. Okay, so these things exist, they're out there, but he feels like he'll sometimes talk about fundamentalism, you know, or fundamentalist Christianity. And he grew up in the United Church of Canada, okay, which is like this extremely squishy, vague mainline Christianity. It's not even Christianity. The priests don't believe anything. And so he was never really exposed to like a well-grounded, strong, intelligent Christianity. And so he has this sort of low resolution idea of, you know, like, well, there's mainline-ish stuff, and then there's like hard fundamentalism over here. And he doesn't think that fundamentalism is correct because he's also deeply into evolutionary science, right? So that's all bound up in his mind. So he's like, well, we can't go back, you know, we can't like unlearn evolution or whatever. And so then my new project is going to have to be grounded in real science, right? So in that sense, he's going to agree with some of what the new atheists are saying. But also he recognizes that they're extremely glib and flippant about human nature. And in the case of Sam Harris, they have a really poor framework for understanding good and evil.
Right. And you mentioned Sam Harris, and Sam Harris had debated Jordan Peterson. They had a debate and
a few debates. It was like this debate series, you know, big long thing. Yeah.
And it's interesting because I kind of appreciated Sam Harris in the way because he kept kind of asking Jordan Peterson, exactly. Are you a Christian? Are you a Christian?
And right.
And Jordan's response, I'm trying to find it here, but his response,
he was just sort of irritated.
He was vague and irritated. And then finally, Sam Harris gets really specific, and he says, do you believe, I think it was the resurrection. Do you believe in the resurrection? And Jordan's response was, that would take me 40 years to
40 hours,
40 yeah. hours, sorry, 40 yeah. hours to talk about or to explain.
Right.
So what is that all about? What is that? What is the 40 hours?
Oh, like, my gosh.
Wandering through the wilderness for 40 hours.
I know. Well, I mean, that Peterson has given, you know, variations on that answer for a few years now. And it's funny because, another time he said, well, that would take me 3 years to understand and study. It's now been about 3 years since he said that. We're still waiting. So there's so many layers going on in that moment. And I tried to kind of unpack some of those. So, you know, at some level, I think Peterson sensed that there was a bit of a status game going on because Harris, in his mind, you know, like, obviously, if you're a reasonable person, right, you know, like you're a reasonable modern guy, your answer is going to be, well, no, of course, Jesus didn't rise for the dead. Or, well, maybe it's like logically possible, but almost certainly not. There we go. Easy. Done. Moving on. Right. So Peterson was irritated because he was sort of sensing the question under the question, which is, are you an intelligent, rational, modern guy here? Or not.
Right.
You know, in front of all these people, please prove to me that you're an intelligent person. You know?
And he wasn't taking the bait.
Exactly. So he didn't want to take the bait. He resented that, which I can understand, you know. But it was still a fair question. So I also, to some degree, appreciated Sam Harris. And so I thought really both of them, in the course of the debate, both of them landed some fair points, and neither of them really won strictly out of the whole argument.
Yeah, and it's interesting because as you said, you know, Jordan Peterson, when we saw him the other night, he was kind of touching on his new series in Exodus.
Oh yeah. Yep. That's coming up with Daily Wire.
Yeah. He kind of got into that a little bit, which was fascinating because, whenever he referred to God in Exodus, he didn't refer to him as God. He only referred to him as the divine, I think, or divinity. I can't remember if it was divinity or the divine. And he kind of talked about, by the way, it was interesting in the audience. There were so many guys, young guys who were in suits with like really like sharp haircuts.
Same when I saw it too. Yeah.
Cause that's his whole thing is like, make your bed, you know,
that's right. Stand up straight.
But I haven't seen the Genesis series. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I've watched a lot of it. I'm not sure if I've watched like every single lecture all the way through, but it's so interesting because, I mean, in one sense, it's a mess, you know, it's just kind of all over the place. And he brings in like some of this like 19th century junk, and he'll bring in Jung, who's garbage, right?
He talks about Jung a lot during the lecture.
Right. And so, I mean, if you look up, there's something called the Golden Bough, which was a big deal in the 19th century. And that lays out this sort of literary interpretive framework for the Old Testament. So, you know, he's deeply into that. That's how he was trained. You know, he was sort of steeped in that way of reading the Bible.
That kind of was it that came out of Germany, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah. So he's, you know, in that respect. But what was so fascinating about the lectures as I just sat through them was he would like go off on these amazing rambling tangents about like lessons drawn from his clinical practice. And when he would get down to like the stories and the characters and the psychology of the characters in the stories, he would go and he would remember people he had encountered as a psychologist and draw all of these threads together and tell like sometimes these amazing stories that were, you know, like they were really tragic or really powerful, and they illuminated something about human nature. And then he would say these incredibly insightful things about, you know, about sin and good and evil and the human heart or whatever. And like at a certain point, he wasn't really talking about Genesis anymore, but whatever he was doing, I liked it, you know. I just wanted him to kind of keep rambling. That sort of was the essence of Peterson. And it was such a weird cultural phenomenon that these epic 3-hour rambling sessions were racking up millions and millions of YouTube views. Like that's not a thing that happens. It just doesn't happen, you know? And they weren't like flashily produced. Like they, you know, they didn't have billion-dollar production values, certainly not like what he has now with the Daily Wire. You know, this is before he had any money. He just rented out a theater and was like, hey, I'm going to talk about Genesis and stuff. Anyone want to come listen? And so people were like, sure, and we'll film.
Yeah, and he's not a theologian. He's exactly. A psychologist. So
right.
Clinical psychologist. So it's interesting that he would do that. And he does mention, as and you talk about this, he mentioned this the other night, the logos. So mm-hmm. What is he, because it was very confusing. What does he mean when he says the logos?
It's hard to parse exactly what Peterson means by a lot of this stuff, because like when you try hard to listen and understand him, he just gets so deep into the weeds. But I mean, I think it's actually, interestingly, it's connected to how he first began to gain notoriety when he was protesting the speech bill, because, you know, for the government to control his speech, his words, right, logos, was to violate for him something sacred, right? Mm-hmm. So speech is sacred. Human speech is sacred. Words matter, which is profoundly true, right? And that's a truth that we really need to recover in this day and age. And so, you know, he's fascinated by the idea of that opening chapter of John, the Word made flesh, Jesus as Logos. And so God is the arch creator, and then we are like sub creators. So God creates the world through his word, and then we also create through our words. And so, you know, he's not really sure what it all means, but he loves that idea, and he comes back to it over and over again.
Yeah, I found it confusing too the other night when he was talking about the logos.
Yeah, I mean, it can get tangled up with other confusing things, but you know, in essence, I think that's what it is, that he thinks he thinks that speech is sacred.
Yeah, and I he debated William Lane Craig, correct?
Yeah, it wasn't a debate so much. It was a
conversation.
It was a three-way. It was really awkward. It didn't go that great. If you try to watch it, it's just like they're talking past each other. And then Steven Pinker's wife is there for some reason, and she's really flaky. It doesn't contribute anything. So it's just this strange deal.
Yeah, and yeah. if you don't know, William Lane Craig is one of the top lead Christian apologists in the world.
That was one of the earliest things that I saw. In fact, I think that may have been how I first heard of Peterson, because my family are very into apologetics. My folks are well-regarded philosophers and Christian apologists, so they actually know William Lane Craig and have corresponded with him. So my dad had seen that dialogue with Craig. So I was like, really? Because I knew who Craig was, obviously, but I didn't really know who Peterson was. And then I went and I watched it. And my initial reaction was, gosh, Peterson's sort of all over the place. This word salad, and what's he even talking about? And
what do you say, word salad? I literally
right, exactly.
The exact like same not, words the other night. I said word salad.
Exactly. Like he's just sort of, he's not really focused or prepped or whatever. And then Craig got up and sort of did his little, you know, tic-tac-toe, perfectly prepped debate thing. And, you know, sort of was better than Peterson in that respect. But then, you know, as time went on and I got more used to Peterson, I watched more of his stuff, I sort of understood a little better what he was doing and his style. And then going back and watching it again with some friends, it was interesting to sort of come full circle. And, you know, kind of realizing that even though Craig is right, so they're talking that I think the topic, it's about finding meaning or value or something like that. And so, you know, Craig is making the point that you need to ground all of these things in theism, that, you know, God has to be the ultimate source and end of all of these things, all of which is true, of course. I agree with Craig there. But Peterson was the guy who, like, had the audience with him, you know, and Peterson could tell a story. And, you know, Peterson had the emotional connection, whereas, you know, Craig felt like he was just sort of reading points off a card, you know? And so it really kind of made me go away and think about how, like, what we could learn from Peterson, you know, in terms of presentation, in terms of what's going to connect with people.
Yeah. And he tends to get pretty emotional in interviews and on stage when he's speaking.
Yeah. And that, you know, I think there's a physiological component to that, if I'm honest. You know, he's always talked about how he has a low tier threshold, just like naturally. He's dealt with depression a lot. So, you know, but also he's just a deeply sensitive guy, and he will, when people come up and they tell him stories about how his stuff changed their life or whatever, you know, guy could be a complete stranger walking up to him on the street and Peterson is already crying, you know? So, it's a special thing.
Yeah. So I think that's one of the reasons he connects well with audiences, because he's very empathetic. But so you mentioned in the William Lane Craig section of your piece, you say Craig neatly and efficiently, which he always does. William Lane Craig neatly and efficiently made his case for Christ that without faith in a personal God, all life is ultimately meaningless. But Jordan pushed back strongly that people can find meaning regardless of where the universe is ultimately heading. He makes an analogy of a celebratory symphony. So talk about that, the Berlin Wall symphony thing, that analogy he makes.
Yeah. So I'd have to scroll through, but I think this was when the wall came down, and there was like a symphony that people played to celebrate it. And so, you know, Peterson was imagining, you know, like the guy who goes around whispering, you know, the symphony is going to end, right? Like, you know, there's not going to be any symphony anymore. The music's going to stop and it's all going to fade away forever and ever. And it's like, yeah, but the symphony is playing now, right? It's meaningful in the moment, you know? And then he also talks about if you've ever had a sick child and you're nursing him through a sickness, and that's, you know, he was probably thinking of his own daughter because she had a lot of health problems when she was a child. So he's like, well, what are you going to tell the parent? This isn't really that meaningful, because what will it matter in a million years? No, obviously you won't and you can't because it is meaningful, which I think was, kind of misrepresenting what Craig meant. It's, you know, it's not that Craig was coming along and saying this isn't meaningful. You know, Craig wanted to say, and he tried to kind of clarify that later in some back and forth. Craig is saying, no, I'm agreeing with you that this is meaningful. I'm just encouraging you to think about why, you know, to try to kind of see if you can follow that out and see where it might be tending, you know, or pointing.
Yeah. And you say in the piece that Jordan Peterson, Peterson, you say in his first debate in Vancouver, Peterson gives Harris the same answer he's been giving since he started having to answer the question in public about whether he believes in God.
Right.
And you say that he, or maybe he says this, he acts as if God exists.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is kind of moralism, you know, that can just lead to moralism if you act. So what do you think? What does he mean by that? That he just acts as if God exists?
I think you're pretty much right. You know, it's a sort of so if you know what Pelagianism is theologically, it's a work salvation kind of a mentality. Yeah. You know, you try really, really hard to be a good person, basically, which there's nothing wrong with that, by the way. You know, like yes, salvation by grace through faith, et cetera. But I mean, there is something to be said, especially in this day and age, for you know, recovering the idea of wanting to be good and trying to be good. So, you know, he talks about, for example, choosing words carefully, trying not to lie, right? So in his 12 rules for life, one of his rules is tell the truth, or at least don't lie. So that would be one way in which he tries to act as if God is watching him, or as if God exists, yeah. Right? You know, so, you know, he's got all of these things, but then he's also terrified because he doesn't really understand the gospel. And so he has this sense of the weight of his inadequacy as a person, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, this crushing guilt. And so it's like, he'll talk about how he's too scared to say he believes in God, in some sense. Because how could you manage that? You know, how could you live up to that? Right.
Right.
Which, yeah, again, the gospel.
The gospel answers that question.
Needs to make an appearance here at some point. Yeah.
Well, it reminded me of, in my book, I talk about this. I talk about Evelyn Waugh's novel, Brideshead Revisited, because.
Which I love.
Which I love. Yeah, novel. Of course. Yeah. I've read that novel good like stuff. Five times, and I watched the miniseries with
Anthony Andrews and Jeremy Irons.
Jeremy Irons in the 80s. Yes. I watched that miniseries so many times. I don't know if I should do a British accent or not, but the character.
No, you do a great British accent.
Okay. The character accent. Charles Ryder, who's an atheist. He's the protagonist in this novel, but Charles Ryder says this about religion. And this is what I feel like where Jordan kind of the space that Jordan Peterson is in. He says, the view implicit in my education was that the basic narrative of Christianity had long been exposed as a myth, and that opinion was now divided as to whether its ethical teaching was of present value, a decision in which the main weight went against it. Religion was a hobby, which some people professed and others did not. At best, it was slightly ornamental. At worst, it was one of the provinces of complexes and inhibitions, catchwords of the decade, and of the intolerance, hypocrisy, and sheer stupidity attributed to it for centuries. No one had ever suggested to me that these quaint observances expressed a coherent philosophical system and intransigent historical claims, nor had they done so, would I have been much interested. Now, Charles Ryder is much more, he's much cynical. More cynical about it,
yeah.
But
right.
But that kind of sums up in a way, just the idea of, well, does Christianity, does the Judeo-Christian worldview have some benefit to society? And it seems like Jordan Peterson is latching on to that in some way.
Right. And in a way, he's saying, you know, as long as it benefits society, that's really the that's really what matters. So, you know, if he encounters a Christian, he's going to say, great, man, you know, you just good for you. More power to you. It's a step above nihilism, man. and so he's not going to tell anyone to not be a Christian, because it's good for that person. It's good for the world for there to be Christians in it. And so that's what Harris was, you know, sort of challenging, because Harris wants to be like, but is it true? Like, I want people to believe true things. And Peterson is like, well, I want people to not kill themselves. So it's like
exactly.
Yeah.
And in that debate with Harris, Peterson says, when he's responding to Harris's question is, you know, do you believe in God or who is God? He says, God is how we, and this is kind of his word salad. God is how we imaginatively and collectively represent the existence of an action of consciousness across time. I have no idea what that means. God, and then he goes on, okay. God is that which eternally dies and is reborn in the pursuit of higher being and truth. God is the highest value in the hierarchy of values. God is the voice of conscience. God is the source of judgment, mercy, and guilt. God is the future to which we make sacrifices. What do you make of all that?
I feel like there's good stuff in there, right? You know, but then I think that the problem is a big issue, and I get into this in the essay, is he tends to depersonalize God. So, yes. You know, he'll sort of wobble around and back and forth with all these things that sort of reduce God to some kind of impersonal force or an idea, an abstract, an idea in the mind of man, right? You know, when really it was man who began as an idea of the mind of God. This is the issue. It's you know, he's conceptualizing the history of mankind as man's search for God. When, you know, C.S. Lewis would come along and say, no, this is the story of mankind is about God's search for man, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and this whole wonderful passage in Lewis where he makes an analogy to children playing hide and seek, and then they realize that they're actually the ones who are being hunted. And Brideshead Revisited, of course, gets into that as well with the twitch upon the thread, right? And that's God twitching on the other side, calling us back. And I think Peterson maybe even now still doesn't really get that, doesn't really grasp the idea of no, God is a person. He's a person. He's a he, not an it, not a, you know, that to
not
which
the
we,
divine whatever. Or not some vague kind of amorphous.
Right. Right. Now, thing. Where there might be some good things that there to work on is where he talks about the highest value. Okay. Or like the source of good or the source of justice and mercy. All of that is true, right? And you could talk about how if you're trying to seek the good, okay, so now we're getting a little bit of Plato in here. And some friends and I were discussing this the other day. We decided that Peterson is kind of a Platonist because he does believe in this idea of value and good as existing outside of us, right? But then, you know, somebody like Augustine is going to come along and put all of this together, trying to speak to the Greeks, to the Platonists, and say, hey, guys, that highest good, right, you know, the value or whatever. Well, all of this finds its roots, its source in the personal God. And so, you know, we can build on what you're saying, but we have to go that step farther. And that's what somebody needs to do with Peterson.
Yeah. And so for Jordan Peterson, you in the piece you wrote, It does. He gets very emotional, as I mentioned before. He gets emotional when asked about, you know, will you commit to surrender to God? And he says he calls it an unbearable task. Mm-hmm. Right? Is that what you and then
yeah?
And then he says, Peterson says it twice. You say, God only knows what you'd be if you believed. And so he concludes, I try to act like I believe. And he adds forcefully, tears flowing, I'd never claim that I could manage it.
Right.
So going back to what you were saying earlier, it reminds me of Isaiah in the temple, you know, when he's just overwhelmed by God and the unbearableness of God's holiness, you know?
Right.
And,
exactly.
And so it's almost like he's in that tension right now where he's afraid of the weight of God's holiness.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Which is, you know, it's such an improvement. And even though, you know, okay, yeah, somebody like Sam Harris thinks more clearly, he's going to sort of press Peterson to be clear about what he's saying, you know, but a guy like Peterson is so much closer to the kingdom than a guy like Sam Harris, because Harris is completely complacent. You know, he thinks of himself as a great guy, you know, it's like, oh, well, or, and I get to Stephen Fry.
Know. I know Stephen right, Fry yeah. is so obnoxious when it comes to his atheism. He's yeah. like, God's a monster. He's a monster. And Stephen Fry, by the way, if he played Oscar Wilde in the film adaptation of someone's novel or no, someone's
he's also Jeeves in Jeeves and Wooster.
He's also what?
He plays Jeeves in the show Jeeves and Wooster.
Yeah.
Which is a great show, by the way.
But, so yeah, talk about Stephen Fry's atheism and what and how that plays out.
Yeah. And so Fry is, I'm not sure if he's written a book like Christopher Hitchens, but he's sort of in that vein of like a really snide British atheists. And he had this very famous clip on Irish television where he had this imaginary conversation with God. You know, if you met God in the afterlife, what would you say? And he launches into this whole problem of evil thing, basically, you know, like, what about bone cancer in children? What about all the terrible evils of the world? And he concludes by saying, just banish God, you know, banish him. You know, things would be much simpler, you know, in my mm-hmm. opinion. So he's very much setting up, we are the judge of God. You know, we get to sit in judgment over God. And Peterson comes along and says, are we really in that kind of a position of moral authority? Because it sure doesn't seem that way. When I look around at the suffering that we cause, right? You know, the evil that comes from things that people do to each other, that would be a much better place to start looking. That's what Peterson is going to say. And so I mentioned this famous quote from G.K. Chesterton, where the paper sends out the question, what's wrong with the world? And Chesterton writes, I am.
And so I want to turn to, you did an interview or you did a podcast with Justin Brierley, who has a podcast called Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And you were on with Douglas Murray. Douglas Murray, I love. He wrote Madness of Crowds. And Douglas Murray is, I don't know if he would call himself an atheist. Or
yeah,
an
I think he's okay with calling himself that. I think he's, but he'll use this weird phrase, Christian atheist, which we can get into a little bit, but yeah.
But he's very, very conservative. So he's this conservative. So he's kind of a new atheist, as you were saying, we were talking about before. He's this right. new atheist who, again, just like Peterson, really appreciates the framework of the Judeo-Christian worldview as a structure that holds us together, that holds society in place and holds us. And, you know, so we're not barbarians at each other's throats, you know, and that God is watching, you know, we are responsible for what we do.
Right. And it's Douglas because Douglas was a moderator for some of the debate stuff between Peterson and Harris. And he would sometimes talk about how he felt like he kind of sat between them both literally and metaphorically. And so, yeah, it was Douglas who brings up, actually, he was quoting David Berlinski talking about, you know, Nazi prison guards, Soviet guards or whatever. What do they all have in common? They thought God wasn't watching them. And that quote had a profound effect on Murray. It's something that he thinks about a lot. And so, and he's coming from the context of the Church of England. And so he was raised Christian. He was raised in the Anglican Church and then went through a sort of crisis of faith. And then he deconverted when he was about my age, a little bit younger, like a few years younger. And interestingly, he was an early protege of Christopher Hitchens. it's so, you know, Hitchens kind of took him under his wing, you know, kind of groomed him into the new whole new atheist mentality. And they were both very anti-Islam, so they had that in common. But Douglas still had all this sort of affection for old religion. So he kind of decided that he was going to trace a different path. He wasn't going to become just another new atheist. He kind of wanted to, you know, he didn't want to beat the dead horse, right? Mm-hmm. Because he didn't see the point.
Right. And it's interesting, David Berlinski is in the same kind of camp as these new atheists, because he
David's
too,
interesting. Yeah.
I love David Berlinski.
Yeah, he's great. Like,
yep. He's brilliant. And he's a mathematician. But Berlinski is interesting too, because it just like with Douglas Murray, Berlinski, and with Jordan Peterson, it just feels like they're so close. They're just so close to the kingdom and understanding the kingdom, but so far in a way.
Right. I think Peterson might be closest of all the three guys you named, because I think he has the biggest heart for what God might be able to bring. But Berlinski, it's interesting. You mentioned it's a little bit of a side note, but it's kind of interesting. He was talking about how talking about Pascal's quote about the God-shaped hole in every human heart, right? And Berlinski sort of gave his one of his little sardonic smiles, and he said, "That hole in my heart is a bit smaller than usual. it's about that big, you know." So it's like, I know. Okay, David, you know.
Well, he's living in Paris and having this really nice life.
Right. And so, you know, I have a little more hope for Peterson. I think that hole might be larger for Peterson.
Well, which gets me to my point, because I just wanted to push back a little bit on what you said in the Justin Barr in the podcast with Justin.
Interview with Murray. Yeah.
With Douglas Murray, and because Justin does this a lot with, because I watched Justin Brierley interview or moderate a talk between John Lennox and Dave Rubin here in Southern California. Yeah.
And what would it take for you? It's like he's always asking you that question.
He kind
right?
of like puts them. He puts these people on the spot, like in front of an audience. Like, what would it take for you to become a Christian? Like. And and so you guys both, basically both of you guys did this to Douglas Murray at the end of this podcast. And what I found interesting / I just wanted to push back on is, I think at the end of the interview, you said, basically the evidence is overwhelming. Like, so what, why can't you just believe? Right. It's something to that effect.
That wasn't quite what I said. Let me contextualize this a bit. So the answer that Douglas gave when Justin asked him that was that he thought that he would need to hear a voice from heaven. And which surprised me, because I wasn't anticipating that answer at all. So I was kind of trying to think on my feet about what to say. If I had been a little faster at my feet, I would have asked what he wanted the voice to say. that would have been a little too pointed for the nice chat that we were having. But instead, what I said was just, well, I don't think that we need to have like a direct personal revelation from God. I think we in the West, who have access to all the information that we could desire, it's not like we're, you know, in some oppressed country locked away from access to the Bible or something. You know, we have information, we can seek out conversations with friends or whatever. And I think that we have enough light to see without that. And then Douglas took kind of a step back, and
sounds Pelagian. See, that's the problem, is that that's very Pelagian to.
I don't think so. So I mean, don't
to say
confuse.
That I can just believe in God without God. The Holy Spirit has to open, like, we're all born spiritually blind. The Holy Spirit has to quicken your heart, open your eyes. It has to be a voice from God, as it were. It has to be a supernatural moment in time when a person is born from above, born of the Spirit, which is exactly what happened to me. I actually did hear a voice from God. It wasn't an audible voice, but it was an internal voice. And that's the thing. It's like, I wish so much in that interview with, or that podcast, that you had told, because I want to talk to Douglas Murray about this so much. I want to say, because he wants to believe, but you can't believe unless God opens your eyes. There you can't. It's impossible.
Well, okay,
to
so
believe.
There.
I mean, you can be
okay.
You can assent to God. You can assent to religion, but to actually have a personal, genuine, real belief, saving faith in God, it has to be come from the Holy Spirit quickening your heart and opening your eyes. And that's what I wish you guys had said to Douglas Murray.
Okay, well, so there's a few different things going on here, and I think we might still have a bit of a difference of opinion here. But I mean, just to clarify, I don't mean to knock the working of the Holy Spirit. I mean, like, I don't disagree at all that the Holy Spirit has to do a work in our hearts, and in fact, I mean, I do think that that needs to happen to Douglas. I think there's some things maybe he needs to let go of and maybe surrender to the Spirit. The point that I was making, though, because I think Douglas did mean an audible voice when he said I would need to hear a voice. I think he was maybe half joking, maybe half not.
And by the way, David Berlinski says the same thing. He says,
"Oh, really? Interesting."
He says, "I would need."
Well, maybe he borrowed it from David. That's
He does it. I don't know if it was the exact same words, but it was the same idea. I need to hear. I need it. It's like I need that experience. I need to have an experience of God.
Right. And so I think in the moment, what I was trying to kind of push back against a little bit was, it sort of was like a gentler, milder version of I would need the stars to spell out my name in the sky or something, you know, like, come on, God, give me like my own personal little sign, right? Like my little special revelation. And I want to poke a little at that and say, God doesn't owe that to you. Actually, he doesn't owe that to any of us. He gave us what we needed to seek him, you know, to pursue him, but I wouldn't affirm a Pelagian framework, because I'm not saying that we save ourselves in that way. It's only through Jesus that we can be saved, and God reaching down to meet us. But I think you used the word assent, right? Like you can assent to, right? And I think that's where pursuing that light can lead you to the place where you're open. Because I think if we don't want God to work in us, if we don't want his Spirit to work in us, then I think God leaves us alone. You know, he's like, you know, okay. But if we ask God to save us, then he will. I think that was the main point that I wanted to make, just sort of, and then Douglas was qualifying. Well, I'm not saying that's just like for me personally that I would need that. For me personally, that's where the bar is, but I'm not saying that that's how high the bar should be for everyone. He was kind of clarifying in that sense for his part.
Yeah, but I wholeheartedly agree with Douglas with that, because I needed to hear God's voice. That road to Damascus kind of moment. Otherwise, there would be no reason for me to believe. Like I went to the church service in 2009.
But you went to church though, right? You were curious, right? You were pursuing that, right? You were following the little trail of breadcrumbs that God laid out for you.
I think Douglas says that he does attend church sometimes.
Right, but not in the, I mean, you have to understand this in like a Church of England type context, know, you know, like there's, what was that?
It's different. Yeah, that's very different.
Yeah, it is. I know, because you have to, and I mean, this is sort of this interesting function of the fact that England has an established church, right? Which is that people get used to it. You know, it just kind of becomes like a part of the, you know, but it doesn't actually mean anything.
Fabric of life, yeah.
Kinda, yeah. And so, you know, Douglas will talk about, and even he mentioned this in a conversation with Jordan Peterson, actually, along with a friend of Jordan's. But Douglas had this little self-aware line where he said that he would catch an evening service where like the choir sings, but there's no preaching, there's no communion, people don't say the creed. And he goes, you know, you don't have to commit, you know. And so I slip into that. It's not very demanding at all, and I can just enjoy the music or the service or whatever, right? So you know, there are steps that he takes. He's sort of very consciously hanging back in some sense, I think, you know, and he'll slip out as soon as people start saying the creed, you know. This is what I mean when I say that there's, you have to get to a place where you're willing to let the Spirit flood you, you know, like you have to let God work in you.
Yeah, I do think that Douglas Murray and Jordan Peterson and even David Berlinski, perhaps, but these new atheists, as you would call them, I mean, I do think I so want them to have, obviously, that experience of God and the presence of the Holy Spirit, and have the Holy Spirit open their, take the scales from. I mean, Paul couldn't believe. Paul was like on his way to kill Christians, and Jesus appeared to him. Paul wasn't seeking after Jesus. He wasn't seeking after.
That is true. And so, you know, you have a fair point there, that we see biblical precedent, and, you know, we even hear conversion stories today where it, you know, Jesus sort of does the equivalent of reaching down and grabbing someone by the scruff of the neck and saying,
"The Hound of Heaven.
He's you're
the
a Christian now." Right. Exactly. You know? And so, God is mysterious that way. I don't know why he chooses to act with some people in that way, but not necessarily with everybody, I don't think. I think everyone's story is different in that way. It's just, you know, some people he grabs by the scruff of the neck, and some people I think he just waits and you know, and allows them to figure it out. And so, I mean, I think Berlinski's comment about the hole in his heart being really small is you know, it's telling, because it's like Berlinski is not expending any effort to widen that hole, you know, put it that way.
He's chosen to keep that
hole very small. And even Douglas, in his little subtle ways, like, oh, I'm gonna go to that service but not that service, right? Oh, I'm gonna don't want to hear that, or oops, look at the time, I gotta go somewhere, you know. You know, they're making their choices. And you know, Peterson may be in his way too, but I feel like Peterson in a way might be more ready to just sort of leap into the arms of God in some sense. You know, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but there's something in Peterson that, you know, reminds me a little bit of the character of Emmeth in The Last Battle, right? Who, you know, he's been worshiping the false god Tash this whole time, you know, which is obviously bad, but he seems good. It's like, I think of Tash as good and true and beautiful, and obviously that's terribly misplaced. And as soon as he sees Aslan, the lion, he realizes, oh my gosh, I've made a terrible mistake. And he falls on his face and worships Aslan, because he suddenly realizes, okay, this is the source of the good and the true and the beautiful. This is where I need to direct my worship now. And Aslan says, yep, this is where you need to direct your worship now, right? But I forgive you, and I accept you into my kingdom. And so that could be Jordan one day. I would like to think so. I'd love to think so.
Yeah. Well, let's leave it there. And guys, if you're watching, please actually pray for Jordan Peterson, because I really do think he's so close.
Right.
So yeah. Pray for him. Pray that the Spirit would move in him and he would understand the truth, and the truth, you know, for real, like the real truth. And so we're going to leave it at that. Bethel, where can people find this article, this piece?
So this article comes from a essay collection. It's called Jordan Peterson Critical Responses, and it's published by Caris Books. And there's a whole bunch of essays in there, which, you know, they're all over the place. They come from all different perspectives. And if you want, I also have another essay on Peterson in a different collection. It's called Myth and Meaning in Jordan Peterson, A Christian Perspective. And those essays are all written by Christians. And so, either one of those you could check out, and my thoughts are in there. And I have some free short articles and stuff floating around as well. You just kind of would have to piece it together. But
well, we'll put links below for those two things that you just mentioned. And you have a Substack, right?
Yes, I do. Which, for those who don't know what a Substack is, it's like a cross between a blog and a newsletter, basically. It's the hot new thing that all the writers are doing. So the URL is just my name, BethelMcGrew.substack.com. And I called it Further Up, which is sort of meant to evoke C.S. Lewis and the idea of everyone finding their way further up and further in at the end of the last battle.
Yeah, and we'll put that link for the Substack below as well. So we'll put three links below. But for now, we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about JP.
Thanks so much for having me, Beckett. Great to be here.
All right. Thank you, guys. And we will see you next week.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Beckett Cook Show. Your support makes this content possible. All episodes of The Beckett Cook Show are also available on YouTube. For more information about Beckett and his ministry, visit his website at beckettcook.com.
Thank you to the team at Life Audio for their partnership with us. If you go to lifeaudio.com, you will find more faith-centered podcasts about prayer, Bible study, parenting, and more.
What do you do when the world around you is falling apart? It's amazing to me how many people are breathing air. They're going about their business and doing the things you're supposed to do. But if you really ask them, they know that on the inside, they are spiritually and emotionally and relationally dead. If we're not careful, all of us can experience that death. When what we need to do, even as the world around us is falling apart, we need to learn how to march when it would be easier to stay where we are and die. Join me each week on the March or Die Show as we discuss that and so much more.